the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Thursday, May 7th, 2015. The UK holds elections today, which The Guardian calls the most complex and unpredictable British election in living memory. We'll go live to London to speak with journalist Afshan Ratansi to find out why. And Medea Benjamin and Doug Henwood will join us for a lively discussion on electoral politics and activism, what the candidacies of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders mean, and how the left can combat election-related mania. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Chenjerai Kumanyika, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at Clemson University. Hi, Chenjerai.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks for joining us. A three-judge federal appeals panel in New York has just ruled that the USA Patriot Act does not authorize the NSA's mass surveillance program, as both President Obama and George W. Bush maintained. The ruling is the result of a lawsuit brought by the ACLU based on privacy violations. Earlier, a lower court had ruled the program constitutional, but the ACLU appealed, leading to today's victory for civil liberties. Section 215 of the Patriot Act expires next month, and Congress is debating on whether or not to extend it. Meanwhile, a group called Transparency Toolkit has used innovative means to create a massive public database of individuals who are contractors with the NSA. Using publicly available data from LinkedIn and other websites, the group created the searchable database named ICWatch and presented it at a conference in Berlin this week. ICWatch features the resumes and details of 27,000 NSA contractors and can shed light on the surveillance and intelligence industry. Well, Chenjerai, how important is this federal court ruling, and what do you make of this interesting database, which is being characterized as a way to watch the watchers?
Well, I think this ruling is a good start. But, you know, I was just at a UDC conference listening to a presentation by Deepa Kumar and Arun Kundani, and they were saying that we have to start to put these conversations about surveillance in the context of empire and race. You know, why does surveillance matter? It doesn't just cause people to center themselves. It also produces particular kinds of security practices. And all of those things affect marginalized communities such as Muslims and blacks in disproportionate ways. So, you know, this acknowledgement is a good start to at least acknowledge what we basically already know, that these problems are, that these practices violate really our human and civil rights. But looking forward, this toolkit is encouraging. I mean, it's going to help us figure out more about how this works, who's involved, and to target specific practices. But one related problem that we also have to deal with is that, you know, in this capitalist economy where data is looked at as a commodity, our personal data is a commodity, companies are very much incentivized to reach further and further into our lives to get it.
And a 29-year-old African-American homeless man named Brendan Glenn was shot by LAPD officers in Venice Beach on Tuesday night. The man was well known among members of the homeless community and was shot by police after an apparent altercation. He was pronounced dead at the hospital. Police Chief Charlie Beck has said he was, quote, very concerned about the shooting, and he added, quote, anytime an unarmed person is shot by a Los Angeles police officer, it takes extraordinary circumstances to justify that, and I have not seen those extraordinary circumstances at this point. Meanwhile, the city of Chicago has just announced it will pay $5.5 million in reparations to dozens of mostly black men who were tortured at the hands of police in the 1970s through 1990s. The Chicago City Council approved the settlement, which is apparently the first of its kind in the nation. The council's ordinance is based on the UN Convention Against Torture, which the U.S. is a signatory to. Activists who pushed for the reparations called the abuses international human rights violations. Chenjerai, I'm wondering if you think that the Black Lives Matter movement has succeeded in heightening the costs of police brutalizing of African Americans.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that this movement has really, at the first level, they've raised the symbolic costs. You know, you're going to, if something happens and your police department is involved in one of these killings, there's a very sophisticated network of social media users and on-the-ground organizations that's going to raise questions and really project this and make these stories into mainstream news stories. If you go to the website wearetheprotesters.org, you will also see that, you know, these organizers are beginning to, have begun to connect these types of this attention to policy and all kinds of other efforts. But I think the other thing that's interesting that's happening is that we're starting to get the story of the multiple layers of economic violence that's also being done to communities like Ferguson, Baltimore, and certainly in Los Angeles, where we have an incredible wealth disparity, incredible homeless population. So, yeah, I mean, I think the movement has been successful.
And that website, wetheprotesters.org, will post it to our website. And finally, days after the story of French soldiers raping children in the Central African Republic broke, the French judicial system announced today that it will take up a legal case. The allegations point to 14 French troops who were serving as UN peacekeepers between December 2013 and June 2014. At least six children between the ages of 9 and 13 have described being raped by the soldiers. The allegations were detailed in a UN report, but kept secret until a high-level UN official leaked them to the press. Authorities in the Central African Republic announced yesterday that they would pursue charges a day before French judges made a similar announcement. The Central African Republic has been racked by a deadly war that has claimed nearly a million lives. Earlier this week, as a gesture of reconciliation, rebel groups agreed to free all child soldiers and other children used as sex slaves and workers. The groups have given UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, unfettered access to their territories to help facilitate the release. Chandra, it's so hard to hear such terrible injustices against children. Does it seem like there could be some justice both for victims of the French soldiers and the rebel groups?
It looks like we're taking a small step in that direction. But if we really want to protect our most vulnerable citizens, which includes children, we have to confront the long and short effects of essentially colonialism. In the short term, these initial steps are important because there's assaults that are happening right now where we have troops occupying essentially this area. Although they're trying to occupy it to address the situation there, we see what the effects of this has been. And looking at the rebel groups, we can also point to colonialism as an important contributor. I mean, it was really, you know, French colonialism that marginalized right. the Muslim population in the Northeast as well. Hmm. So I think we have to connect these dots if we really want to ultimately protect these citizens.
Chandrai, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Chandrai Kominyika is an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The UK is holding elections today, and according to The Guardian, it is the most complex and unpredictable British election in living memory. Unlike in the US, the UK has a parliamentary system, and rather than voting for national candidates, voters will choose their own Member of Parliament. There are 650 seats in Parliament, and the political party that wins a majority chooses who is Prime Minister. Incumbent Prime Minister David Cameron heads the Conservative Party. Traditionally, it has either been the Conservative or the Labour Party that have won majorities. But today, because of the rise of third parties, such as the UK Independence Party, led by Nigel Farage, that duopoly could come to an end. The major issues at stake are the economy, immigration, and the UK's membership in the European Union. Joining us now from London is Afshin Ratansi. He is the presenter of RT's Going Underground news and current affairs show, broadcast around the world. He's a former producer at the BBC's flagship Today Show and a contributor to Counterpunch. Hi, Afshin.
Hi, Sonali.
Now, which of the two major parties is likely to win more seats today than the other? And what are the options if a clear majority does not emerge, which is looking extremely likely? Won't they simply form a coalition government like other parliamentary democracies do?
Well, it is polling day, and the betting shops are as good as any to find out who's going to get the most seats in Parliament. Nate Silvers, that famous pollster from the United States, says it's too close to call, and certainly elite media usually go with American pollsters. Must remember that two of Obama's pollsters are advising the two major parties here. Yes, basically, the Scottish Nationalists seem to have broken the mold, which means that no overall majority can be held, according to opinion polls, by either of the two major parties, which means that our first past the post system, criticized for being unfair by smaller parties, but the bigger parties always saying, no, this is a way to get decisive government, it's failing the British people, it seems.
So the Scottish National Party, which has been emboldened by the recent narrow loss of the Scottish independence referendum, is looking like the likely third party that's going to emerge, winning possibly, I understand, all 59 seats in Scotland, which will give them, and which essentially you're saying is going to break the stranglehold of a majority by either of the major parties?
Yeah, it's not quite Syriza in Greece, but one has to understand that we have an onslaught of oligarchic media owners. Rupert Murdoch owns the best-selling newspaper here, The Sun, The Times, Sky News. We have huge vested interests on both the Labour and Conservative side from the financial services industry, which has been bailed out for the austerity policies. For the SNP to get anywhere near the 50 seats in Parliament that are being predicted will be quite an amazing victory, because the SNP want to get rid of our weapons of mass destruction program, the nuclear weapons program, let alone perhaps reform elements of the financial services, which usually win out of British elections.
What about the Liberal Democrats, which has been the traditional third party for some years now?
Yeah, the Liberal Democrats last time around proposed that they were the anti-war party, because one must remember here that both the two largest parties here, of course, supported the Iraq War, Tony Blair famously, and indeed they both supported the bombing of Libya. So the Liberal Democrats were this anti-war party. It looks like the Liberal Party, as they were, which is a history of centuries of governance in Britain, may finally be finished once and for all. Though the leader of the Liberal Party, who I should add I went to school with, though I can't remember him, he actually seems to think that because of the strange way British politics work, there will be some element of balance of power politicking by him. And there were reports by big trade unions that support the Labour Party that they would order Labour's leader to do a deal with the Liberal Democrats. But so far, the signs have always been Liberal Democrats working with the Conservatives.
And Nick Clegg is the leader of the Liberal Democrats. Now, does the failed independence bid from last year have a chance at revival if the SNP wins a substantial number of seats and can, you know, wield some influence?
Yeah, we've got to remember that the Scottish Nationalists are doing well, and previously not particularly aligned to progressive forces. And there will be no doubt that that issue will come back on the table. But to give an idea of the kind of poverty north of the border, the so-called revival after the 2008 crash has been, all statistics show it's been in the southeast of England. I mean, there are people in suburbs of Glasgow, infamously, who have shorter life expectancies than that found in Gaza,
wow,
for instance. So the kind of poverty we're talking about, I mean, it's not as bad as certain areas of Baltimore, but, you know, there is a real sense of outrage and injustice north of the English border.
Let's talk about the UK Independence Party and its controversial leader, Nigel Farage. He seems to have become something of a cult figure. His main issues are immigration and membership in the EU. He's against both. How much of a role has his party played in the election, and how popular is his party? Time magazine said his popularity might be waning. I suppose it certainly remains to be seen how many seats his party wins.
Well, if Time magazine says that, maybe he's on the up. It being such a good reverse barometer. Yes, the media were fascinated by this figure because, of course, with austerity, we find greater xenophobia. And so UKIP have monopolized elements of the media when it comes to third parties without ever showing that they seriously posed a great threat to the status quo. So far, people are saying that UKIP voters are switching to the Conservatives, though it has to be said that while UKIP is often criticized for having so many racists and xenophobes in its party, its foreign policy is an isolationist one. So there may be comparisons that you might have in the United States with those on the libertarian right in the United States in that sense. But It's been overwrought, the power of UKIP, I believe, though immigration as an issue certainly isn't. And Britain's Labour Party even issued mugs saying, controls on immigration, that's why I'm voting Labour. So wow. Labour very much in with trying to use the austerity to create division in British society.
And just staying on UKIP, the UK Independence Party, for a minute, David Cameron, the incumbent Prime Minister, once called UKIP a party of loonies, fruitcakes and closet racists. Is that sort of accurate?
Well, that's I think the leaders of the UKIP party would say that's very similar to the old Conservative Party, and many of the candidates at today's election for UKIP were Tories. So that's a fight amongst the right. What we now have in Britain is really perhaps a progressive majority when it comes to seats in Parliament.
And actually, can you explain, the UKIP won 28% of all seats in the recent European elections. What do European elections mean for our US audience?
Yeah, European elections with very low turnouts are actually on a different electoral system, not first past the post, which does favour third parties. So because of the vagaries of the electoral system, that's why UKIP did so well at European elections, albeit as people on the left in Britain and on the right say Europe is a pretty undemocratic way of operating given the bureaucrats in Brussels. But whatever happened in the European elections, it does have implications for this election, because legitimacy, democratic legitimacy, is already being talked about. David Cameron has raised the issue, presumably if there's a deal on the proto-left, and I'm sure Labour would if the Liberal Democrats and the Ulster Unionists get together with the Tories.
What about membership in the European Union? I understand that the Conservative Party is for the UK exiting the EU, while the Labour Party is against it. How serious is the possibility of the UK exiting the EU?
I think the mainstream Conservative Party isn't for leaving, because, of course, it does it helps the profits of the big multinationals that support the Conservative Party. And I've got to say, you know, we have huge multinationals supporting Labour and Conservative parties, JP Morgan and PricewaterhouseCoopers on the Labour side, big multinationals on the Tory side. So they probably wouldn't want to see a European exit. But there is a push from perhaps coming up to a majority, tired of the way the European Union has been undemocratically holding an influence over Britain. And of course, at the moment, it's very alive because of a TTIP negotiation in secret at the moment, which would perhaps break up the National Health Service, the public healthcare system here, which is one of the leading issues of the election in totality. And the European Union certainly, presumably, wouldn't like a national healthcare system, as it's encouraged private healthcare around Europe.
And the TTIP being the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, similar to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, which many here in the US have mobilized against. Now, finally, I know it's not done to ask for serious speculations on what the votes will bring, but if, as it appears, there will be no clear majority, could we see days of negotiations and indecision about who the prime minister will be, who the major ruling party, our ruling coalition will be in the coming days?
We could, indeed. The FTSE financial index is down 1%. Bond prices are up, strangely. These kinds of things showing the city is so far a bit uncertain, because ultimately the major political parties, the Tories and Labour, they put $1.3 trillion into bailing out the banks here. And every media outlet has been talking most of all about how we must have cuts in public services to pay off the losses of all those bankers. So if I was going to make a prediction, I'd say whatever change there is going to be, it doesn't look like it's going to be hurting the financial services industry too much as yet.
Afshin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonali.
Ashton Rastansi is the presenter of RT's Going Underground news and current affairs show broadcast around the world from London. He's a former producer at the BBC's flagship Today Show and a contributor to Counterpunch. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Hillary Clinton is working hard to attract progressive voters. She announced her campaign on the promise of reducing income inequality after a major speech denouncing the system of mass incarceration that has imprisoned millions of Americans and disproportionately African Americans. She has also announced her full support for immigration reform, going even beyond what Obama has embraced. Clinton went on the record saying she supported a path to full and equal citizenship. On the foreign policy front, Clinton is paying far more lip service to the right, having aligned herself with Henry Kissinger, a man whom many progressives consider the most notorious U.S. war criminal. Possibly complicating the field for Clinton is Bernie Sanders, whose recent announcement included that he too would run for president. At the very least, some hope that he will present a progressive foil to Clinton on domestic economic issues. On international issues, that's another matter, as Sanders notably falls toward the right, specifically on U.S. allegiance to Israel. And then there's a relentless push by some activists to recruit Senator Elizabeth Warren to run for the election. Joining us today to discuss these issues are Doug Henwood, political economist, author of After the New Economy, editor of Left Business Observer, host of a Pacifica Weekly program called Behind the News, and Medea Benjamin, longtime peace activist, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink and the human rights organization Global Exchange, and author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Welcome to Uprising, Doug and Medea.
Thank you.
Well, Doug, let me start with you. Is it fair to say that Clinton seems to be, broadly speaking, tacking to the left of Obama on domestic issues and tacking to the right of Obama on foreign policy issues, or is that just too simplistic?
Well, it's really hard to say what Hillary actually said, other than, you know, the status quo. She is doing a rather aggressive imitation of someone who's progressive on domestic issues. She's denouncing income inequality. She spoke recently of toppling the 1%, even as she's trying to raise a lot of money from them. She's talking about ending mass incarceration despite her husband's contribution to it. She's in some sense running against what she's been working at for the last 20 or 30 years. I don't know if anybody's going to fall for it, but I wouldn't trust it for a moment.
And do you agree with that, Medea? You recently wrote a piece calling Hillary Clinton a hawk.
Well, she certainly is a hawk. She was a hawk when she was a senator. She was a hawk as Secretary of State. And she's a hawk now. Her policies have been disastrous. She supported the invasion of Iraq. She called on Obama to double the number of troops in Afghanistan when he was talking about the surge. She was disastrous in the policy around Libya that led to the overthrow of Gaddafi and the dysfunctional state that exists now. So I would certainly say that while she's trying to position herself as a liberal on a lot of social issues, she is definitely a hawk when it comes to foreign policy. On the other hand, we should admit that she has been supportive of Obama's talks with Iran, which is a positive thing.
Doug Henwood, should we be taking very serious lessons, the left, I mean, taking very serious lessons from President Obama's campaign during his campaign for the presidency? And of course, he was a much more blank slate than Clinton is. Clinton has the baggage of many, many years, not only as state senator, secretary of state, but also, of course, first lady. But Obama made so many promises that he never kept. And if people fall for Clinton and her promises, will we be fooled twice?
Well, I would think so. And as you said, Obama was a blank slate in some sense. He was much easier to project fantasies of what he might be, you know, the community organizing history. And he can talk a good game. He's very impressive, as is Hillary. These are very sophisticated, intelligent, crafty people. But, you know, Hillary has a very long record. And she, I read this cover piece for Harper's last fall, Stop Hillary was the arresting title they gave it. And when I started doing the research of the piece, I thought she was much more of a passenger on the Bill Express than she actually turned out to be. She's been a very much collaborator. It's been a very much a partnership of equals from the beginning. They've talked about this strategy of 8 years of Bill and 8 years of Hill for 40 years. So she has a very, very long record. And most of it is on the conservative side of the Democratic spectrum. And she's obviously not Marco Rubio, but she is aggressive on foreign policy, as Medea pointed out. I'm not sure I really believe how supportive she is of the Iran deal, given her allegiance to Israel and to us, for a Democrat, surprisingly, to Netanyahu. She's just, she and Bill practically invented the whole regime of teacher testing in Arkansas, the anti-union stances they took in the early days in Arkansas. So they invented this kind of modern new Democrat philosophy. And now that is really old and out of fashion, she's trying to throw it over. But I don't know, her history is a little too long just to believe some religion that she suddenly gets in the heat of a campaign.
Medea Benjamin, you wrote about the meeting that you had and your organization, Code Pink, had with Hillary Clinton more than a decade ago, where essentially she agreed to talk to you about her support for the Iraq War. Can you describe that meeting for our audience?
Well, I'll never forget that meeting, and it's nice that we do have a video of it, because we went to her office and did a sit-in, and we were about 100 women. It's Code Pink, and we were at that time wearing pink slips. And the idea is that we were going to her office to say either we were going to be supportive of her stand around Iraq, or we were going to give her a pink slip saying we didn't need her services. And because we refused to leave her office, her staff said, okay, we will get her. She was on the floor of the Senate. They put us in a room where all of us could sit down. They brought her from the Senate floor. We told her that we had just come back from Iraq, that the Iraqi people were desperate because they were so afraid of a U.S. invasion. They had no idea what they could do to defend their families. And we said that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We talked to weapons inspectors while we were in Iraq, and they said there were no weapons of mass destruction. And could she come out and say that she would not vote for the war? And she basically sounded like she was George Bush. She said, you know, I am a senator from New York. I have to protect my people from New York, and this is an evil man, and blah, blah, blah. And at the end, my co-founder, Jody Evans, took off her pink slip and basically threw it at Hillary Clinton and said, we don't need your services. Unfortunately, we still have had her services for a long time. But I've heard that there are people who are going to go to her campaign appearances with the list of over 4,000 U.S. Soldiers and who died in Iraq, and start reading off those names, trying to hold her accountable for her vote.
Now, Doug Henwood, one of the things that Clinton has come under strong criticism for, well, there are many things, and I do want us to take the time to go through them. But she and Bill have been involved, including her daughter Chelsea, have been involved in the Clinton Foundation, which has come under fire, most recently for their global initiative being hosted at a meeting in Morocco by a Moroccan mining company called OCP, known for serious human rights violations. And in the past, it's also come to light that companies like ExxonMobil and Monsanto have donated to this foundation, and they might be pulling back their support now, probably realizing that they're going to be a liability for a Clinton presidency, and who knows what sorts of backroom discussions have been happening there. But should we see the ties of the Clinton Foundation as a, you know, is it proper or appropriate fodder for discussion on President Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, you know, before I answer that, I'd like to just add a footnote to what Medea said. When the vote for the Iraq War is coming up, Hillary deliberately did not read the National Intelligence Estimate because it was skeptical about the WMDs in Iraq, the secret one, the one that was released to the public. Was some of the skepticism was erased. But she did deliberately did not read that because she so wanted to vote for the war that she didn't want to complicate it with facts. And that's not like her. She's the kind of person who reads documents. So that was a really strange and deliberate decision to vote for a war that she probably knew was being launched on false pretenses, but she had to play along for political reasons. And now we'll go on to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, this is a very interesting family. This family has gotten rich off politics in a way that I don't know if there's any precedent for. It's like the family business. And now they're bringing in the younger generation. And they've been used this thing to, this conservative book by Peter Schweitzer has some problems. But you know, I think he's getting to something, that they're selling access to an ex-president, then Secretary of State, and a possible future president. And for rich people and big corporations and big foundations to give a few $100,000 or even a few $1 million to these people, it's pocket change for those folks. But, you know, it adds up. It's made the Clintons multimillionaires many times over. And they've raised, I think, $2 or $3 billion over the last decade or so from these sorts of interests, predominantly financial, media companies, these sorts of very, you know, very big names. You know, she is the senator from Goldman Sachs, or was the senator from Goldman Sachs in many ways. So it's really smelly. It's a whole system of selling access and back scratching and ego inflation. And it's really not a way of democracy it should be run. And, they're very devious about what they release. We don't really know who's given what and what has been gotten in return. And it's just a very, very smelly business.
Amidia Benjamin, on the same question, what do you make of the Clinton Foundation and whether we should be considering its method of doing business when assessing Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate? And also there's a controversy about very sloppy tax returns being filed, which really does make one wonder because, you know, certainly it's important for there to be not only financial transparency when we look at a presidential candidate, financial transparency in their dealings, but in general, how open they are to outside scrutiny and to filing proper tax returns. I mean, this should be a simple thing. These folks can afford to hire good, tax preparers.
Well, I think everything is open, and particularly in terms of the foundation and the many corporations that have given money to the foundation, because this really has implications for her economic policies, her policies around trade deals, and she has not been consistent about that at all, supporting some trade deals, opposing other ones. So I think it all relates to her very pro-business stand and her interest in the foundation put her in very cozy relationship with a lot of companies that many of us are not comfortable with.
And Medea, there's also the controversy of Clinton using her own personal email address, which was housed on a private server while she was Secretary of State. That controversy seems to have waned a little bit. It'll probably come back in the media coverage. That too doesn't bode well for transparency, does it?
No, not at all. And I think that was a tremendous blunder on her part. And I'm surprised that it
Do you think it was a blunder or something more insidious?
Well, insidious and a blunder at the same time, because it's a blunder if you think that she's smart enough to know that this would come out and that this would affect her. excuse me, I'm surprised that it's subsided, but it will certainly be an issue during the campaign. And as you said, it is an issue about transparency. And with the sensitivity that many of us have around our government's lack of transparency, and we have the case of Obama being one of the least transparent, I think that it does not bode well for Hillary Clinton that she has such a bad record on this already.
Much more to talk about, including Bernie Sanders' candidacy, but staying on the Clinton candidacy for a little bit, I want to discuss the way it's being viewed in popular media. Saturday Night Live's Cecily Strong headlined at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, D.C. on April 25th. And I want to play for our audience and our guests today a little bit of what she had to say about Hillary Clinton.
I'm excited about Hillary running, though I'm not sure she's excited about having to run. I think she feels the same way Meryl Streep feels when she's asked to audition for something. Are you kidding me? You making it go through this? I mean, you know I'm gonna win. Ugh. All right, guys, now This next part is a repeat after me, so I need your help here. I want all the media to put their hands up and swear something this election season, okay? I solemnly swear not to talk about Hillary's appearance, because that is not journalism.
Cecily Strong of Saturday Night Live speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner April 25th. Well, there's a couple of issues here that I thought are well illustrated. First, the sense of entitlement that Clinton is being made to run a campaign, and we should just all assume she'll win. And the other issue, of course, how the media is going to cover her. Doug, on the first issue, is there a sense of entitlement?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, she's raising $100 million for this primary campaign. So
wow, $100 million.
For, no, I wouldn't say exactly uncontested, but, you know, the likelihood of her winning is close to certainty. So raising $100 million for that is pretty amazing. And then eventually she's going to, you know, probably raise a billion or more for the general. But, yeah, she's had this sense of entitlement for her entire life. If you go back and, you know, read the history of her days in Arkansas, again, she got... When she was working at the Rose Law Firm, she was like, they needed a swimming pool. There wasn't one in the governor's mansion. She wanted those, and it just like one thing after another. And this led to one compromise after another with power. You know, whatever progressive instinct she had when she was in college and in law school quickly evaporated when she became the partner with the Rose Law Firm, and she became, you know, the loyal servant of corporate Arkansas, doing business before the state when her husband was attorney general and governor. Yes, there's a sense of entitlement and also of intense sense of secrecy and arrogance. The email scandal is entirely consistent with her whole history. She hates the press. She hates publicity. you know, you start talking about the Whitewater billing records and people think you're nuts, but they disappeared for a year and a half or 2 years, and they suddenly reappeared again in a private room in the White House. So Hillary lost those and found them again when the time became convenient. She has this history of evading scrutiny because she thinks she's above it, and she thinks whatever she does is the right thing, and nobody should ask any questions. And that attitude is really not what we need right now. We need, you know, she's very secretive, and she's very much, I think she'd be very much into surveillance. So we've had enough government secrecy and enough government surveillance, and I think she would actually intensify it if that's possible. So it's a bad combination.
Medea Benjamin, on that same issue, not just the sense of entitlement, but also I think what Cecily Strong made, which was a very good point, which is that probably the worst things that progressives are going to have to fight against in criticism of Hillary Clinton is sexist media coverage, right?
Yes, on the one hand, I think we want to agree that her looks should not be an issue in the campaign. Her level of estrogen should not be an issue. I saw the op-ed about how she'd be a good candidate because she's postmenopausal, which is, you know, disgusting, and implying that somebody who is premenopausal would not be a good candidate. All of that should be banished from this talk about the campaign. But on the other hand, we also shouldn't say we want her elected because she's a woman. She is a woman. It would be wonderful to have a woman president, just like it was wonderful to have an African-American president. But we want to vote on people based on their positions on the issues and not based on their gender.
Let's also briefly, and Mehdi, I want to stay with you and then go to Doug on this issue as well. Hillary Clinton has, and I mentioned this earlier, has made it very clear that on foreign policy, particularly, she stands right there with Henry Kissinger, which is really dramatic. In fact, it was a year ago, and I wrote a column on Truthdig about this, how she wrote a review in a major paper of Kissinger's book, and how it was just incredible the way in which she cozied up to a man that the left considers one of the worst war criminals in recent U.S. memory. I mean, doesn't she realize that might cost her some progressive votes?
Unfortunately, I don't think many Americans even remember the legacy of Henry Kissinger when he was testifying in Congress recently, and Code Pink went up with our banners saying, arrest the war criminal, waving handcuffs in front of him. We got so many people saying, why are you against this nice 91-year-old man? What a terrible thing to do. So the United States of Amnesia unfortunately is true in this case, that most people really have no idea about Henry Kissinger, except that he's a nice 91-year-old man. On the other hand, yes, it is horrendous that she would cozy up to Kissinger, and it's horrendous that she would support Kissinger-like policies today, such as supporting the coup in Honduras. We know that Kissinger not only supported the coup in Chile, but was one of the architects. But we can fast forward to the coup in Honduras, where Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was very anxious to legitimize the coup government in Honduras and has done so.
Doug Henwood, on the same issue of cozying up to Henry Kissinger, I'd love to get your thoughts. And also the challenges that you are going to face personally as a male critic of Hillary Clinton. And I think you already have faced people labeling you a sexist for being a critic of, you know, President Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, you know, what can I say? I certainly avoid all the sexist caricatures and denounce them whenever I can. They're revolting and distracting and have nothing to do with what's wrong with her. I want people to hate her for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. You know, the thing with Henry Kissinger is also very consistent with her history. When she got to the Senate, she promptly made a beeline for the Armed Services Committee. She's very comfortable with generals. She is, I think, much more hawkish than Obama. I mean, I think, although, you know, she says she supports the Iran deal, I don't think, had she been Secretary of State, she would have negotiated as energetically as John Kerry did. And had she been president, I don't think she would have pushed for it as energetically as Obama did. I think she is very, very warlike and has been for almost her entire life. You know, she was a Goldwater girl back in the 60s. Although she certainly shed some of that republicanism, that kind of militarism is still deep in her character, and it shouldn't surprise us that she fawns all over Henry.
And then, Doug, let's talk about Bernie Sanders before I want Medea's opinion on that as well. So Bernie Sanders had long sort of flirted with the idea of running, finally did announce his candidacy. In fact, in an Iowa straw poll, he polled right behind Hillary Clinton with 15% of the vote. Significant, not significant enough, but significant given that he is openly a socialist. And you as an economist, Doug, I'd love to hear your opinion on his candidacy, but also how the media are viewing him as a foil for Clinton, sort of this convenient prop that Clinton can set herself against.
It's going to be interesting because there are people who are saying that, you know, Hillary should deserve the nomination eventually, but she has to work for it a little bit because it'll make her a sharper candidate. That's a very strange understanding of what the primary season is supposed to be about, but I think a lot of people looking to it for that. And then she can sort of practice her populism as well in campaigning against Sanders. And he, of course, will, you know, certainly not going to launch an independent challenge. He'll probably support her when she wins the nomination. I'm not so sure how serious his challenge is to her. His policy proposals are rather thin. A friend of mine is actually doing some advising of the Sanders campaign and says there's really not much there. His policy people are very weak. He doesn't have much in the way of ideas. He's got a few emotional slogans that he's been throwing around for a couple of decades, but there's really not much substance to his proposals, and maybe he'll develop those as the campaign goes on. And it's certainly good to have somebody who is, I guess these days, a socialist is actually just a Keynesian. That's what's happened to our political spectrum. I think it's important to hear people, for people to hear Sanders talking about the things he's talking about and will talk about in the campaign. Warren has forced, Elizabeth Warren has also forced Hillary to talk about inequality in totally unbelievable ways, but she is at least forcing her to address the issue. And I think Sanders will also do the same.
So, Medea Benjamin, your opinion on a Sanders candidacy, and I should mention Sanders, who's an independent candidate, has chosen to run for the Democratic nomination rather than as an independent candidate. What do you make of it? And also, given that, one of your main expertise is being foreign policy, how you feel about Sanders, who seems weak on foreign policy, except on Israel, he actually takes a strong stand, but in the wrong direction?
Well, I think it's great he's running. You know, I look at the cast of characters for the Republican Party, and every day we have a new crazy person running for president. I think it's great. I wish that there were a wider cast of characters in the Democratic Party, and I'm glad Bernie Sanders came forward. I wish Elizabeth Warren were run. I wish that Jill Stein, as Green Party candidate, would get the kind of press that she deserves. Bernie coming in is only a good thing. Is he as good on the issues as I would like him to be? No. And you brought up, Sonali, the issues around Israel. He certainly will not stand up and say, let's cut the $3 billion in aid that we give to this repressive regime every year. He blames Hamas for the Israeli invasion of Gaza. And, you know, while he talks, he's way better than Hillary Clinton on the wars. He hasn't been very forthcoming about opposition to the drone wars. He talks about cutting the Pentagon budget, but he doesn't really come out with a, here's my position of how we should slash the Pentagon budget by X percent. He says, well, we don't want to raise it to the detriment of education and healthcare. So look, it's very good when other people enter the Democratic race from the left, from the right, wherever they're going to do it, just so we have more of a debate. And Bernie Sanders is certainly going to be way better than Hillary Clinton on issues of war and peace. But we need somebody to the left of Bernie Sanders, like a Jill Stein, and to really push her more on these issues and to push the whole debate in the whole country.
Jill Stein, who ran as a Green Party candidate for governor of California. What about Elizabeth Warren,
and
Medea?
For president and, last
and for
time,
president,
and
that's right.
For president.
And what about Elizabeth Warren, Medea? Any opinions on that?
Well, you know, I think Elizabeth Warren on the economic issues is just fantastic. And I also find her more inspiring than Bernie Sanders, who tends to be more curmudgeonly just as a person. I think that many women and people in general would be inspired by an Elizabeth Warren candidacy. And she's actually more easily to push on some of these foreign policy issues, perhaps, because she is new to them. And we have seen from some of the extreme lobbying that we call it, which means not just making a phone call or going to talk to an aide, but actually doing sit-ins in her offices, die-ins in her offices. Right after the last Israeli invasion of Gaza, we went in as mourning mothers with rubble that we just dumped all over her office in Washington, D.C., and refused to leave until we could have a substantive talk with her top aides on these issues. And she has moved slightly on this. So I think it would be exciting to have her in the race. Unfortunately, I don't think she's going to do it.
Well, Doug Henwood, let's talk broadly speaking now about what happens to progressives and progressive causes come election time. It seems to be that a lot of movements get derailed because they expend a lot of energy, not just into the sort of basic get out the vote types of activities, but into actually campaigning for presidential candidates who are already getting so much money from corporations that they could simply hire others. But it happens every 4 years that very well-meaning, sincere activists leave their nonprofit work or other organizing work that they might be doing to go and work in campaigns. And a lot of people just get seduced by the idea that if only we had the right person in the White House, if only, if only, if only.
Yeah, I think it's very depressing to see this happen every 4 years. I've been through enough cycles now that I'm very familiar with it. But, you know, it's just the same thing happens again. People do not remember what they said or did 4 years ago and how they're disappointed 4 years ago or 8 years ago or, you know, 16 years ago. It's just the same thing over and over again. We fall for this. If we don't work for this Democrat, then the fascists will take over. You know, this rhetoric has been around. When I was doing some research a while back and came across a 1964 article by Hal Draper, which is like quoting that sort of rhetoric just change the names and you have the same thing today. It's amazing how we just go through this endless repetition of the same. I think presidential politics for people, progressives, people on the left, are mostly a distraction. That it is so much an elite office that the ruling class has such a lock in that office that you can get the St. Francis in there, and it's still going to be a ruling class office. And you know, it's part of the job description is performing war crimes. It's just, I don't think that getting the right person in there is going to change much of anything. I think it's much more fruitful for people to organize, you know, locally and around specific issues. And the presidency is going to be for the billionaires. And that's just, until the broad landscape of American politics changes significantly, that's always going to be true. We have to change it from the bottom up. And I don't think the presidency is the place to start.
Well, Medea Benjamin, what is your opinion on the same issue, the role that or the way in which electoral politics subsumes the left every 4 years? And also then, do you feel that the best role for progressives ought to be to strongly critique every single candidate on the right or the left that we see from the left, critique them from the left?
Well, of course, that should be our job. And I agree with Doug, it's mainly a distraction and we should be critiquing them from the left. But we should really have learned a lesson from Obama. And I see why people were so attracted to Obama. And I don't see the same level of attraction that will probably happen around Hillary Clinton, with young people in droves leaving their jobs, leaving their school, taking semesters off. Yes, some will do that because she's a woman and they want to see a woman elected. But it wasn't the same kind of thing when there was the possibility of the first black president, somebody who wasn't from the ruling dynasty itself, who was a fresh face, and at a time when we were so destroyed with 8 years of the Bush regime that people were just so anxious for a change. I'm hoping that we can use this time to be building the mass movements we need to build and to be challenging all of the candidates from the most progressive position possible. I'm hoping that we see this is a time to connect the Black Lives Movement to the militarization of our country in general, to connect the environmental movement to the issues of how we spend our money, our budget priorities, what we need to do to move into a peace economy, a green economy. We saw what happened with Obama and the peace movement, which is that the peace movement died. And because the peace movement died when Obama came into office, we have 12 years of drone warfare, 12 years of perpetual war in the Middle East and beyond. I think it's time for us to really reflect on our role in building grassroots movements that connect to each other, that are not tied to the hip to the Democratic Party or any party for that matter, and that our role is really to build from the bottom up.
Now, and let's actually focus for a minute on the way in which candidates like Hillary Clinton and in general, traditionally Democratic candidates have worked to seduce communities of color to be, you know, there to support them. And they've reliably been able to count on voter support. And Doug Henwood, I want to ask you, Medea brought up the issue of the Black Lives Matter movement and Hillary Clinton's actually quite powerful speech on mass incarceration, where she clearly laid out that there's something deeply wrong with a system that, you know, that so disproportionately incarcerates young black men, that, you know, will that not seduce, rightly so perhaps, you know, African-American voters? Because who else at this point is speaking to these issues? Bernie Sanders hasn't brought them up well enough. Other left candidates may have brought them up and aren't getting attention. And the right, none of the right-wing candidates are certainly bringing it up.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. She gave that speech in the presence of former New York City Mayor David Dinkins, and I think it's an institute at Columbia named after him. And he was the guy who started the police buildup in New York City, even before Giuliani took office. So, you know, we have to look. The Democratic Party's record in this stuff is not so good. There's and certainly Bill Clinton and his crime bill was just a horror, in increasing the number of federal death penalty crimes and encouraging an acceleration in the process of mass incarceration. You know, so she can say anything she wants now, but you know, she does have to confront that record. And I, you know, forgive me if I'm skeptical that she's actually going to do much of anything about it. I think she's just playing the purely opportunistic game now. She realizes that the environment has changed, that there's not the support for the get tough on crimes, crime position that there once was, with crime rates way down. That just doesn't have the emotional resonance it did in the 80s and 90s. But you know, I really find it hard to believe that she would launch any major reversal of this policy of mass incarceration. I think she'd look for modest technical reforms, you know, better training, better monitoring. This is the heritage of the Democrats in the crime thing, which in the long run only tends to legitimate, serves to legitimate mass incarceration by making the process look fairer and less less vicious. You know, I think it's really something that needs to be scrutinized very carefully with a whole lot of skepticism. I don't think she's the right agent for this.
And then, Medea Benjamin, the same question on the issue of Latinos and the Latino vote and the vote of newly naturalized citizens. Hillary Clinton very recently using terms that even President Obama hasn't used, wanting full and equal citizenship, a path to full and equal citizenship. And she very clearly laid out saying, this is where I differ on with everybody on the Republican side. Make no mistake, not a single Republican candidate announced her potential as clearly and consistently supporting a path to citizenship. Many communities who have undocumented relatives, many have come out reacting quite positively to this. And of course, it's important to hear this lip service. Advocates for immigration reform, as well as, you know, the Dreamers, etc., are obviously thrilled to hear this. But, you know, is this, again, a seduction of a core constituency?
Well, of course it is. I mean, she's a calculating woman, and she knows exactly where she needs to get her votes from, and she's got a huge machine, and this machine is telling her that this is what she needs to say to get the support from this community. And I totally understand why the immigrant rights community would be delighted to hear these words from her. But I think it's also a community that has learned over the course of the Obama years to be have a healthy degree of skepticism and cynicism. And it's also a community that knows that grassroots activism is really what's going to change things. So I assume that this community is going to applaud her for her words, but keep the organizing going.
Well, we just have about a minute left. Doug, I want to get your last thoughts on this issue, and if we have time, Medea, as well, on how you expect the next few months to unfold, not just with where the candidates might go, but the media coverage that you think might, it does just hope the media coverage, I suppose, stays focused on the right issues.
Well, I think it's going to be pure hell, a torrent of lies and cliches, and it'll be excruciating to live through. I wish I could go into hibernation for the next 15 months or so. I'm not so dogmatic that I think that there could be things that would be marginally better to have Hillary as president than to have Ted Cruz as president. There's no question about it. The Republican Party is insane and frightening. But I think we should not have any illusions about what they're like, and certainly not give up on any mass mobilizations. Like Medea pointed to the collapse of the peace movement. That's very important. You can multiply that into many other areas where people should remain alert, skeptical, and keep the pressure on and not give up just because Hillary's in the White House.
Medea, last few seconds, your last thoughts?
I would say the same thing as Doug, that we're going to be bombarded with all of these candidates, and I hope more will step forward for the Democratic Party. But let's remember that no matter who is in the White House, our power will come from how good are we at building up a broad grassroots base that intertwines all of these issues and puts the pressure on whoever is in the White House.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. My guests are Doug Henwood, political economist, author of After the New Economy, and editor of Left Business Observer, host of a Pacifica weekly program called Behind the News, and Medea Benjamin, longtime peace activist, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink, and also Global Exchange, and the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali. Nice to be on.
This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Alexander Holmes is our technical director. Federico Garcia and Kiana Turner are our audio engineers. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprising with Sonali. Your subscription sustains our TV production. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.